Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the Seymour Centre at the 2018 Festival.
Hello. Hello and welcome to Sydney Writers Festival 2018. My name is Jamila Risby and I'm delighted to be welcoming you all here today. This session is titled Daring to Drive, A Saudi Woman's Awakening, just in case anyone is in the wrong room. I'd like to acknowledge that we meet on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging, as well as extending an extra special welcome to any Indigenous Australians who are with us here today. Before we begin this morning, a couple of very quick housekeeping matters. Nobody actually turns off their phones anymore, but if you could put your phone on silent, that would be very much appreciated and will save great embarrassment to you later on. I'm going to ask that you don't record this event, and if you can, keep the photos to a minimum. Manal will be available afterwards to sign books at the Glee bookstore, and I'm sure we'll be very happy to pose for photographs then. But you can buy the book first if you want a photograph. If you'd like to join the conversation on social media, you can tweet, Insta, hashtag, Snapchat, whatever else there is in the last 10 minutes that's been invented. The hashtag is Sydney Writers Festival, all one word. And we're going to chat for about 40 to 45 minutes and then leave a good 15 minutes at the end for you to be able to ask some questions. So please be thinking about them now. You know when you have a bird and it's been in a cage all its life. When you open the cage door, it doesn't want to leave. It was that moment. That is how my guest, Manal, felt for the first time when she sat behind a wheel of a car in Saudi Arabia in May 2011. Having earned her driver's license in the US a year earlier, the actual practice of driving wasn't particularly difficult, but to take the risk of driving on her home soil, filming it and uploading that video to YouTube proved revolutionary. Manal, welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival. Please put your hands together. I want to begin by setting the scene for your memoir and speaking about life in Saudi Arabia. And at one point you say, Saudi families almost universally reflect a contradictory combination of extreme intimacy and extreme segregation and impenetrable privacy. Can you tell me a little about what you mean by that and what life was like in Saudi Arabia for you growing up?
Yes, it's interesting. So in Saudi Arabia, we have the segregation between the men and women. This is first. So the only men I grow up seeing is my brother and my father. And even my teachers in school for 5 years, I studied computer science. I never saw them. I saw them through CCTV. I couldn't even talk to them. But at the same time, the Saudi society is pretty much into each other. We're on top of each other. We think that because we always... provide this advice for free. We always feel like I can come to you and talk to you because I care so much about you. So you always have these people getting in your life, trying to interfere in your life, how you look, how you walk, how you dress, how you pray, how you sit down. And so you're always under constant monitoring from all people around you, even your friends. Even your friends think they have the right to come to you and tell you how you should act or be. And that's very difficult for me. So in a way, we live in homes where it's completely dark like this room, although we have sun 365 a day, but all the windows are locked to keep the privacy. And at the same time, if friends, family, even strangers in the streets can come and talk to you, you're not wearing the hijab the right way. So that's the contradiction.
I want to ask a little bit about what the guardianship system was like in Saudi Arabia for you when you were growing up and living there. Because I think we've all read about it in the newspapers, and one of the things I loved about your book was that it really brought to life for me what it was like day to day for you living. Could you share with us a little bit about how your life was restricted day to day because of the guardianship system?
Can I ask for a little light? I like to look at the audience when I talk.
Thank you.
Hi. Assalamu alaikum means peace be upon you. Thank you for being here. Good to meet everyone. So the male guardianship, anyone, ladies here, you have children, right? Imagine your child become your guardian. We were driving, me and my ex-husband, and his mom was with us in the car. crossing the borders to UAE, from Saudi Arabia to UAE, I had Abdullah, my first son. He was in my lap. And the guy at the borders asked his mom when he handed all our passports, "Who's your guardian?" "Auntie." And she pointed at her son. She's 67. That was the moment of truth for me. I was holding Abdullah, and I was looking at his grandmother, pointing at her son. And I'm like, if this boy ever become my guardian, I'll kick his butt. So that was a huge moment of truth to me, that my son, I could give birth to my own guardian. So growing up in Saudi Arabia, I was born 79. Growing up, I had a huge list of things I couldn't do without a guardian. Getting healthcare, getting education, working, getting married, leaving the country, getting my passport, getting my papers, leaving the house. I have to ask my father for permission. And they kept telling us, because you're a queen, and queens are taken care of. That's why you need someone to escort you, someone to take care of you, even driving, of course. And thankfully, this guardianship system is being diluted and dismantled slowly. Few things now only I cannot do without a guardian. But growing up with such a huge list of things I couldn't do was huge for me. I looked for the things I could do growing up, away from the guardianship. And believe me, in Saudi Arabia, all the things they tell us we cannot do, we always find ways to do them. Always. This is funny, when you try to control people and put restrictions on them, they will always have ways to build a ladder and climb on top of the wall, or just go through around the wall.
When you were growing up, you speak about in the book the difference between the way you were raised and the way a little boy in Saudi Arabia would be raised. So yes. Even at a very young age, yes. You were treated completely differently. And I grew up in a Muslim family as well, but it tended to be around the age of puberty that boys and girls started to be treated very differently. True. For me. But that wasn't the case in Saudi Arabia. You were treated differently from the beginning.
We had restrictions like didn't jump, didn't ride the bike. I always find ways to ride my brother's bike. But yes, puberty time is the time where we were completely separated. So my cousins, we used to play together, we pull each other's hair, we break each other's toys, and suddenly, like, they are strangers to me. You cannot talk to them at the age of 12. And it's like losing someone who's still alive, but you're losing them. And they were my best friends. I grew up with boys. I'm quite the tomboy inside. I always enjoyed boys' games, like football, climbing a tree. And then suddenly, no, you have to sit down in the house with the girls, play ladies. You know, when you play the tea party, I wasn't made for that. So that that really hurt. And when my mom passed away 2 years ago, we were in the funeral, and they were helping us take the coffin out. And I saw men around me. I didn't know who they are. I'm like, who are these men touching my mom's coffin? As Muslims, you carry it to the prayer. And my brother, he's like, those are our cousins. I grew up with them, and I've seen them 30 years later. Like, I grew up with them, and I've never seen them. I didn't know. If I passed by them in the street, I wouldn't recognize these are my cousins.
Your mother, when she was alive, never ate on Mondays and Thursdays.
Yes,
can you tell us about why that was?
Ah, interesting story. You understand, in our society, as Muslim and Arabs, especially Arabs, it's the culture that's way more important than religion. So the culture is the culture of shame. A woman's virginity is the one the whole family honor depends on her virginity. So that virginity that I didn't understand growing up, really, why I couldn't run, not run, like ride a bike or jump, because you could lose your virginity. No one explained this to me. And
I would have liked to hear their explanation.
The only thing I heard from my mom is just like, if you find blood, you are ruined, right, broken. I'm like, what's broken? Like my Barbie, I didn't have a Barbie, wait. You have to read the Barbie story. It's like my toy when it's broken. I didn't understand. So we had a neighbor who is 12 years old. We were like five and seven, me and my sister. And he tried to he asked me to remove my underwear. I'm sorry to say this in the morning. You just had your coffee. And I didn't understand. I was 5 or 6. And I didn't understand why he wanted me to remove my underwear. But mom, my sister, she went and she told mom. And mom thought we lost our virginity. She took us, believe me, it's not funny at all to take your children to the doctor to check their virginity. I didn't write about this in the book. But mom, when she interrogated more, she went to the boy. She threatened to cut his male members and hang it on his head, on his neck, if he ever come close to us. But then when she interrogated more with me and my sister, she found out that we're still virgin. He couldn't go beyond whatever she had in her mind. And she made a vow that day, I knew about it years later, that she will fast all her life, every Monday and Thursday, which is Prophet Muhammad's way of fasting, for the rest of her life if her daughters are still virgin. And when she interrogated, she found, until she died, she was cancer patient, she kept that vow. And that really shocked me to know how huge and important it is when you have girls in the house to secure and seal that virginity for them.
You were a ferocious reader as a child, and you talk about loving Jo in Louisa May Alcott's novel,
Josephine
Little
Martin.
Women. And I want to ask, what was it that so appealed to young Manal about Jo? Why did you love her so much?
Oh my God, Josephine Marsh. Anyone read Little Women? Of course, of course. So Josephine Marsh, she was quite the rebel. She was different than her sisters. She rode a bike. That's the first. And she wanted to be a writer. I've always wanted to be a writer. So she was my role model. It really broke my heart when they put her in the end of the novel, when she got married. It was the second one, second novel, when the publisher asked her, no, she has to be put back in her place, find a husband and get married. I'm like, you killed it for me. So I'll stop at the time when she went to New York and became a writer. And for me, that was quite the thing I wanted to do growing up.
And you've done it.
And with all the restrictions that she had, she was she would ride a bike with her dress. And if you read about Susan B. Anthony, so Susan B. Anthony is one of the feminists in the U.S. who called for women's suffragette, and she campaigned for women's vote. Do you know what she used to emancipate women in her country? She asked them to ride bikes. And she said, I've never seen anything more liberating for women than a woman on a bike, riding a bike. It's so emancipating, she said. Free, give her this free spirit. I'm like, oh, she understands me. Women and cars in my country, for me, it is emancipating for me.
There's a beautiful synergy there between the bikes and the cars.
Actually, there is a book, How Women Rode the Bikes to Freedom. There's a book in they talked about the suffragettes in the U.S. It's not the tool, really. It's just why we don't concentrate on men. We concentrate on women. It's always when a woman knows her worth, when a woman knows who she is, before the world told her who she should be, she's unstoppable. And she can change the world around her, including men.
You speak in the book about the fact that your devotion to God and quite a fundamentalist practice of Islam really intensified in your teenage years in particular, and far more so than your siblings. What do you think it was that prompted that for you?
So in Saudi Arabia, growing up in the 80s and the 90s, we had this huge radicalism movement in the country. And I think I'm quite zealous in the heart. When I believe in an idea, I really fight for it to the end. And I wanted to be a good Muslim. And at that time, we had the Bosnia and Herzegovina, the Yugoslavia war. We had the Chechnya war. We had the Palestine Intifada. So we had all these things happening at the same time. And we had this rhetoric in the Islamic sermons. They've been telling us, we are under attack. The whole world is coming to attack. And this is how you become a good Muslim, because now is the time to become the best Muslim to protect the Ummah, the Muslim world. And I think people like me, like my brother and my sister, were not that immune, really. They had part of their life. Maybe me, I was the longest one that took my radical years. Because when you live in a country where you don't have access to books, other than the books the government allows you to, when you didn't have, even when the internet came, it was heavily censored. So you only listen to one version of the story, and this is really dangerous anywhere in the world, and I've seen it in the US. They listen to one version of the story and they block the others. Even if it's there, we're too lazy to listen. We just listen to what people feed us or what the media, the prominent media feed us. And that what happened in Saudi. My brother and sister, they went through some, like my sister, she covered her face. She went through some radical years. But I was the one who would make sure I execute the laws and the rules that we were taught in schools in the house. Like banning my brother's cassettes at that time. Music cassettes, because they told us it's haram.
You burned his cassettes, you burned your mother's magazines,
yes,
I think?
God bless my soul at that time, that I didn't know better. But so we've been taught this is how you save your family, this is how you follow. So I was the police in the house, trying to save my family from hellfire. And I'm not proud of that, but this is one part that I use to really understand how radical. And radical doesn't mean radical in Islamic or religious way. Radical is any ideology that isolates you from the rest, that creates, that dehumanizes the other, that creates this wall between you and trying to be open-minded. Your heart is open and your mind is open to understand the other human beings who are different than me, why they're different than me, and not being feeling that I know the truth. There's nothing called I know the truth. Truth keep changing. Like my truth when I was growing up changed than my truth today. It's your opinion and your world, but once your freedom is really stepping on someone else's freedom, this is the one that you just say stop. This is not freedom anymore.
You write early on in the memoir really beautifully about the first pop song that you ever heard, and I think you were in your 20s.
22 or 23, I think.
Can you tell us what the song was and what it felt like to hear that kind of music?
I'm pretty sure a lot of people know Backstreet Boys. And my brother, he would buy NSYNC and buy Backstreet. It was in the 90s. And I walk in the room.
Oh,
and
you
my
don't
brother,
have to excuse that behavior as 90s. It's still wonderful music.
It is, right? It's so beautiful. Anyone heard Show Me the Meaning of Being Lonely?
Yes.
I felt so lonely listening to that. That was the first one voluntarily, I would say, listening to. And my brother wasn't in the house. I took the cassette and I listened to it. I had this big stereos, if anyone remember, with the two cassettes where you can record. Quite sneaky what I used to do. I take my brother's music cassettes and I record sermons on it, saying why music is haram. So instead of listening to NSYNC or Backstreet Boys, he would listen to
You'd
someone shouting at him. He forgave me. This morning, we were just talking, and we always laugh. He's a metalhead, by the way. And he's like, please stop telling people about my pop time. It's his credibility.
It's a time of great shame. Him listening to Justin Timberlake.
Yes, exactly. And I was at age 21 or 22 when I listened to it. And I'm like, how come such beauty, such beautiful, beautiful thing, which is art, it's demonized. It didn't make sense to me. Mm. I was in Cockatoo Island this weekend. If you haven't gone, please go, it's free. You just take the ferry, and they have the human flow, Ai Weiwei, from China. And there are other way more beautiful pieces there. And this thing, I know it's a huge problem now, the refugee in Australia, but when you go to Cockatoo Island, as an Australian, who hear all these radicals, yes, your right wing, saying terrible things about other humans. And you go there, and you just confront yourself, looking at this huge raft. He went Ai Weiwei to the same Chinese restaurant, factory restaurant, I'm hungry apparently, that they create these rafts. And he asked them to create this huge, huge, humongous raft that you will find in Cockatoo Island. And he made sure to make the refugees on these rafts with the same material, that rubber, the black rubber, with their kids in the middle. And he put all these quotes around it. I was in tears. The thing art do to us as human, it does change our conscious. No matter 100 articles, 100 book you read, books, yes, because it's art. Any art really change because it doesn't confront you. And you're voluntarily going to experience that. And people really, you forget what they said, but you never forget what they made you feel. So that feeling I had there was huge. So in Saudi Arabia, art is being put under siege. It's been put under ban. We don't have museums. We don't have galleries. We don't have music. We don't have... And I understood why. Because it does change your personality when you experience art, whether music, whether a good movie, whether going to such a gallery. It's amazing.
The other thing I think that is central in your book in terms of expanding horizons is education.
Yes.
And I was really struck reading that your mother in particular went to great lengths to make sure that her children were educated, including
yes.
the girls.
Yes.
What do you think was driving her in that regard? Because her being so ferocious about your education, ambitious for your education, struck me as somewhat unusual.
So growing up, I come from a very poor family. Thankfully, with all the things I couldn't do, thankfully, education was for free. Higher education. Not only free, they pay you to go to college. So that was the thing. I always concentrated on the things I could do, not the things I couldn't do. Mm-hmm. And one of them was education. Mom was deprived from her education for the same reason, because she grew up in Egypt, where boys and girls study in the same school, and her father was very conservative. At the age, when she was fourth grade, he removed her from school. She never forgave her dad for that. Mm. And she said, my children will finish their education. So my sister is a doctor, I'm a computer scientist, and my brother is a geologist. And thankfully, because college education and higher education is free in my country, mom insisted that we become best in the school, and we finish all our education. And I remember in Saudi Arabia, when you are finishing your high school, suitors start coming, and mom... She didn't tell dad. Usually the mother goes to the mom first, and then if they agree, the fathers get involved. Of course, the woman is the last one to know. And I didn't know that mom, she was rejecting and she was refusing suitors when we were in school age. And she told us later why she did it. She's like, for me, a woman, she should get good education and be financially independent before she finds a man. And that's really important, because that means... you own your own opinions. You are independent and you are whole and enough on your own. You really don't need someone to complete you, because you are already complete. So that's the time when you have the right person showing in your life. Mm. And I think mom, she understood this in a very, very early age. And I didn't understand it at that time, but I'm very grateful for my mother.
Yeah. Tell us about university, because your learning experience, again, was very different from the men who were at the same
yes.
university.
Yes.
You didn't have the same opportunities,
no.
despite sitting the same exams and
no.
being expected to perform in the same way.
So going to college, I was top in my class. And I remember, not only in my class or my school or my city, I was top in the region. So I was number one. My name was in the...
Oh,
no, I just didn't want to disappoint mom, really. And when they said, when you are the top, when you are the first, there's a 5,000 rial, which is around $1,500 award. Coming from a poor family was like, it's a huge thing mm-hmm. for me. And I even made a list for mom, I'm going to buy all these things with the money I'm receiving. I went to the ceremony, and there was no money, nothing. They just gave me a certificate, not even we didn't. There wasn't that much really... I would say celebration of us. And that's the day I realized I will give myself everything I want. I will not wait for anyone to give it to me. And that's what made, when I went to college, I wanted to study physics. And I walk in the class, and we were seven girls. And at the same time, there were around 1,500 girls applying for accepting exam for the computer science. I never seen computer in my life. And I thought, okay, I think that's the future. I'm going to apply for the computer science. I was accepted, thankfully, without even passing the exam because of my high grades. And my family had to put, not my family, my cousins, when they knew I'm computer science, they had to collect money from the family to buy me a computer. So my first computer was a loan that I never paid back. But when I graduated, my girlfriend, she said, do you think that you ever, because computer science, you work in tech, and in Saudi Arabia, we are only 11% until this day in the workforce. So you graduate, 58% of the computer science degrees are given to girls in my country. 58%. To compare, the US, 18%. Mm. This is how huge it is. But there are no jobs. So out of the 60 girls we graduated, only two got jobs. And she said, before I got the job, she said, didn't even have hopes that you will get a job. You'll just work in one of these institutes teaching Microsoft Office. You might just get 4,000 real, which is around $1,000. I was lucky to work in Aramco, which is the oil company. Aramco was started by Americans. They allow women and men to work in the same place. And I call her when I got the job, and it was 8,000. And I say, Maram, guess what? I got a job with Aramco, and the salary is double. I got a job in exactly what I do, computer science, and the salary is the double. And she said, where is this job? I said, in Aramco. Aramco men and women work together, the only company in Saudi Arabia where women and men were allowed to work together. She said, you never get married. I never called Maram after that, and I married someone I worked with, that's the other thing. But that was a huge thing for me, to work in a company with men, secretly from the whole family. And that was another challenge. There's a whole chapter about working in Aramco. It's called Homeless and Unemployed. I'm not gonna talk about it. I'll keep the suspense to know what happened to me working in an all-male environment for 10 years.
I'm going to skip that part then. We're not gonna talk about Aramco at all. That's a reason to buy the book if you haven't already. But you did meet your first husband there.
Yes.
And you had a son. Can you tell me about that relationship and tell me about your bigger little boy?
Abdullah? What type of relationship you want to talk about? We fell in love, that's the interesting thing. But the more interesting thing, when the girls at the work knew that there's feelings between us, there was so much pressure. It's amazing the thing we do when you are under pressure from society, when there are expectations, when you feel like you betrayed your family because you're talking to men, you're working with men, and you fell in love with a man. I was in love with him, but we were not really a good match. We were very young. I was 23, he was 25. He was told he wanted his mom, and I wasn't his mom. I was someone who was outspoken. I didn't wear the niqab. I removed the niqab at the age of 23, and that terrified him. And he insisted that I leave work, but he was working with women. Ladies, trust your guts. No matter what the society, what the world is telling you, if it doesn't feel okay here, it's not okay. And everyone around me, so much pressure from the society that you talk to this man, now you have to marry him because now no one else will marry you. Like, and also why we put so much pressure on the marriage. I was sitting with a girlfriend and she was showing me her classmates. And she's like, she's engaged, she's married, she has kids, she's this. And I'm like, why are you defining a woman by her marital relationship? Why don't you define a woman, she won this award, or her dream is to become a scientist? So it's also how we put women in these boxes. And this is how when I was working, there was so much pressure on me working with men. That means you're a walking shame. Now when you find a man, now you have to marry that man, even if he's not good enough for you. Mm. And I had to... I took so many decisions in my life because to please people, to make people quiet and happy. Guess what? They will never be quiet and happy. Society will always criticize you. This is what I learned. People will always find something wrong about you, especially if you're outspoken, if you're yourself. And nothing confuses the world more than being yourself. And that the thing I didn't realize, if I go back to myself when I was 23, I would talk to her this way. Just be who you are. Love who you are. You don't need to make anyone happy. You become happy. That was most of my decisions at a very young age, was to please the society around me, and they were never happy or pleased. I was always not enough for that society. This is why I moved to Sydney in November last year. And this is the first time in my life, no one knows me. I can walk in the street, no one recognizes this is Manal Sharif, and I can do anything I want. Not anything I want, like illegal ways, no. I got speeding ticket, yes, but it was. but I just can be me without anyone's expectation. And that feeling is so beautiful. Anyone experience that, to go to a place where no one knows you, and you're just like, oh, hi, this is me. Now I'm realizing who I am. And I love it, this feeling. This is the first time in my life.
It's a feeling of freedom.
It is. Liberty, freedom, high. I don't know, you. And I love it.
So I grew up in Australia, also in a Muslim family. And I remember one of the most freeing moments of my life was the day I got my first driver's license. And I remember just thinking, yeah. And I went home and I picked up my little sister and I said, we're going to go drive through McDonald's because I can drive. And my mum remembers waving us goodbye and thinking, what if they both die at once? And she was just terrified. She said it was a horrible day. Talk to me about the freedom of getting your first driver's license.
That's an interesting story to hear. Ladies, all of you have your driver license? Great. If you don't, you're not my friend. I think I never thought of it this way, but just in living in a country where you cannot have, where we don't have public transport, we cannot walk in the street or ride a bike. So the only means of transportation, it is driving. And in the same country that really goes to the extent of impossible, crazy things to separate us from men, they make sure there is a complete stranger driving your car, living in your house, the driver. The
to drive you
driver.
Around.
Yeah, to drive you around. That was the huge contradiction. When I was in the U.S. in 2009, and I got my driver license at the age of 30. It was actually in May 10, I got my driver license. It was really liberating feeling that I can just stop my car and go wherever I want. It took, from the time I started the movement in 2011 to the time they announced lifting the ban, because for sending me to jail, I told my mom, I think this is my life purpose, is to never stop campaigning until the first driver license is issued to a woman in my country. June 24 this year, women will drive officially in Saudi Arabia. June this year, that took from 2011, 8 years from the time, June 17, which is funny, it was June. It was June 17, our movement. And I think that's the day women will realize their full potential, when she's free to drive herself, when she's free to be not the word safe. When you trust someone, she's not trusted on her own life. We have children driving their mothers. Mm. They put them in cushions because the mother cannot drive. I think that's the key of change. Exactly like what Susan B. Anthony, woman, you can't. Changing the society really start from changing. Forget about policies and politics. And really, when women change, the whole society change. Because we as women, we don't really only care about us. We really care when we have jobs, when we reach prosperity and abundance. We always think of people around us, mothers, fathers, children. We always give. We always extend. While men pretty much, they're centered on themselves. Even when a man gets married in my society, he's pretty much to himself. His money goes to himself and his kids, and he wouldn't think of his mom and dad. While women always extend to the mother and father. I still pay my father's rent until this day. And that's how women really, when you empower them, the whole society is empowered. The whole society goes prosperity. Think if women are leading the world today. We'll be sitting in a salon having our nails done, discussing world peace and what's the next country that we want to drop food packages or flowers or whatever on them. While men, they're just thinking, what's the next country we have to bomb? It's a completely different world when women are there in the power, when women are there sitting at the table and writing policies. It's completely different, whether a family, whether a politics, whether a company.
And yet you speak in the book, when you talk about the sort of system in place in Saudi Arabia, that so much of it is culturally entrenched,
yes,
rather than about religion or even the law. And women are often as fierce at enforcing, yes, that cultural entrenchment as the men are.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's most of the country's patriarchal society, women are protected of patriarchal societies. Mm. You find this in Mediterranean countries. You find this in Eastern European countries. Women are pretty much zealous when it comes to protecting the patriarchal society.
Yes.
And I think it's the same in my country. Mom's generation is different than my grandmother's generation. My grandmother's generation she raised three kids by her own, she ran her own farm, she had men in her house. But mom's generation was the radical movement time where they accepted to be put in boxes and be invisible. And I think my generation are the one who are claiming back the true culture, because the culture that you see today in the Arab world and in Saudi Arabia is not our culture. I always say I want to be like my grandmother. You find all these old ladies, they drive their car, they have guns, the ones who live in the desert, the rural areas, and they're pretty much very powerful. And then because of the article, these four decades we had, how women changed. And now we're just claiming it back. My best friends in Saudi Arabia are the ones born in '90s. I'm like, I'm born in the wrong generation. Because I've been calling for these things, because I've been radical myself. And sometimes I'm thankful for the radicalism, because you are there. You understand what it feels to be looked down to and be inferior just for your gender. And then how you had to go and question every single thing you've been told about you. So when the radicals, I talk with them, I come from the same background when they talk to me. I'm corrupting a lot of Saudi women. That's a nice thing. A lot of my girlfriends stop wearing the hijab. I have nothing against the hijab. But for me, personally, it has nothing to do with Islam. If you read the original textbooks of Islam, it was imposed on women later on. It has nothing to do with Islam. It's not even mentioned in the Quran. It's mentioned as a sitar, which is a curtain between Prophet Muhammad's wives and his visitors who are attending. And that's it. There's nothing. And how it evolved to become a full face covering and how it evolved to become burqa, it's all the looking at the women as inferiors. And we're just claiming back that we're not inferiors and has nothing to do with my culture. I'm just claiming back my culture.
Forgive me if this is too personal a question, but I know when my grandmother moved to Australia, that was the first time she used to wear niqab, so full
the
covering.
Niqab. Really?
And the first time she ever removed it in public as an adult was when she moved to Australia. And my grandfather made her take it off on the aeroplane. And for her, living uncovered in Australia, she never got used to it, and she hated it. How did you feel for the first time uncovering publicly? Did it feel liberating, or did it feel terrifying?
It was confusing. I felt naked, really, because I've always covered my face. But it's natural. Why God gave you a face and asked you to cover it? I've always questioned this question. Like, why? Why he gave me a voice and asked me not to use it? Again, going back to trusting your guts. And I think it takes time, because you cannot force things on people. This is what I learned. Everyone in this earth for a different reason. Everyone has a different purpose, a different path to walk. And to fulfill that purpose, you will have to go through certain experiences. You just need to be really open-minded about it and not impose. But go and experience whatever you're going through, because that's preparing you for your, if you have deep connection with your inner soul, your inner being, you will have the feeling, the things that really put you in the way to fulfill your purpose. And I do believe that we cannot change people's mind. The only thing you can do, like when I said corrupting women, I never try to change their mind. They just see who you are, and when we go through discussions, without imposing your opinions, you're just talking about the experiences you went through. And let them go through the experiences they have to go through, because their path is different than me. Things change, really, when you don't impose it on people. When she was forced by your grandfather to take off the hijab, that's the thing that really bothered her the most, because it wasn't her decision.
The forcing
to
is
take
the problem.
It off. Yes. It was when you force people to do something, they will always feel uncomfortable, even if it's the right thing. They will always feel uncomfortable. And I'm talking about personal, not talking about laws, paying taxes or speed limits. No, I'm talking about personal. Once you impose things on people, this is why I think it's a big debate in Europe and Australia for the banning the niqab. And a lot of people ask, well, believe me, I would never wear a niqab, but I would never force it or force taking it off.
Yes.
Because I was forced to wear the niqab most of my life, and I hated it. And in Tunisia, they were forced to take off the hijab. So when the Tunisian ride when they are on an airplane, the first thing they do, they put on the Tunisian woman, they put on the hijab. The first thing Saudi women do, they take off the hijab. It's human nature. You cannot force these things. Just let people decide. My son, when he comes and asks me questions, I always say, I give him a lot of answers, and I say, but I want you to look for answers yourself. Don't be lazy. And at the end of the day, follow your heart. And this is when you read my book, the first dedication after my mom and dad was for my kids. And I said, question the rules, never yourself.
I'm not going to go into it here because I want people to read the book, but the chapter where you talk about driving and the filming is happening, I remember thinking, oh, what's that noise? And realizing my heart was beating so fast. You've got a beautiful writing style and an ability to take the reader back to that moment. I felt really anxious, like sweating and heart beating. I was really worried about what was going to happen, even though I knew you were fine because I was interviewing you. And I knew it was going to work out and you were going to be okay, but I was very, very scared. Where did the writing talent come from? You said you wanted to be a writer since you were a child.
Ever thought, had a dream and knew it's going to happen. Growing up, when I look at my diaries, we were always locked in the house doing nothing. For 23 years, I was locked in the house. This is why every single day when I wake up in the morning, I make sure I leave the house. Even if I step out the door and come back, I can do this. I think books were the only friends I had when I grew up. And reading leads to writing. So I used to write, even in my hands. Even if I find a piece of paper that's empty, I feel guilty. It has to be filled with something. I wrote the book in Arabic, translated it to English. My translator, she's from the UK, who studied in Egypt. She did a very good job, really. But I also owe a lot to my editors. The editors, believe me, you will hate them when you work with them. They will slash your book left and right. This is like, I had a huge... I remember the first chapter, it was like... How many words the first chapter? It was like 40,000. Huge. No. We're going to slash this and lift that. So they really did a good job. It took 6 years, this book, in the making. So it wasn't overnight. There is a word in Greek, says meraki, which is means leaving piece of your soul in whatever you do. And I think writers, you can tell when you look at the piece, whether a book, whether an article, whether a piece of art, you can tell. It was done with love. There's a piece of the artist here talking to me. And I think when I was writing this book, so many tears shed there, so many days where I hated just, I don't want to write, because I had to go through all my daddies, I had to go through all the things was written about it to write these chapters. It was really difficult. But at the same time, I'm the best thing I hear from my readers is a page turner. I couldn't put it down. One, he tweeted to me at 4 a.m. He said, I have an exam at 7 a.m. I cannot put your book.
I'm going to fail and it's your fault.
I couldn't put your book down. I want to know what's next. That was so beautiful. And I think whatever thing you do in your life, really do it with love. That tells if you love your work. If you hate your work, please don't do it. Quit. Do something else. And that's, I think, what makes something that's worth doing. Writing been always my friend. Growing up, I always wanted to write my life story. I was 10, and I'm writing in my diary, one day I will write the book of my life. I don't know who's going to read it, but they're going to read it. And imagine a 10-year-old write such thing.
There's great ambition in that 10-year-old.
I think we got the red light. I want to ask.
We do.
I want to ask.
It's your turn, everybody.
I want to ask something.
Oh, no, it's not. It's Manal's turn.
Yeah.
Sorry. You're answering now.
Who's under the age of 40?
Could we have just a slightly little bit more light from the
audience?
Yeah,
and less light in my face. Oh, much better. This is so strong. Can you? The light on our face, just a little.
We're going to move the furniture next, so.
Yeah, I'm going to play piano.
Settle in.
Improvise. Who's under the age of 40? One. Welcome. You're 80% of Saudi population. Mm. 80% of the Saudi population are under the age of... And we've been always ruled by people in their 90s. So there is this huge gap between us. Mm. And things are changing today in Saudi Arabia. We have... He's your age. He's 32, the crown prince. We had the cinemas reopened reopened for the first time in 38 years, last 2 weeks ago. So me and my son were talking, like, I'm coming, I'm taking you for a road trip in June, I'm taking you to the cinema, and we're going to have a popcorn. So really things beautifully changing in Saudi Arabia. Mm.
I would like to open the floor up to questions. Yes. And please note my particular use of the word question. I will not hesitate to go all Tony Jones on Q&A on your ass and say I'm taking that as a comment and shut you down. But we would very much like to hear some questions from the audience because you've heard well enough from me but not enough from Manal. We'll go straight to the centre here. I'm sorry, the lights are very bad.
Manal, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank
very
you.
Much appreciated. My question is about the political reform and social reform that's occurring in Saudi Arabia now.
Yes.
I'd like to hear your comment on it.
Yes.
And some reflections on whether it's genuine.
It's the same question I've been asked all over and all over again. Is it genuine? I hope and I wish it is genuine. It's just what troubles me that the women activists back home, they've been shut down, banned from travel, and that's not giving me good signs. I keep speaking up. I'm very thankful I wasn't put back in jail. I've always speak up. And I hope the new leadership, they realize two things. You cannot run the country in the same way you're running it for the last 80 years, absolute monarchy, one of the last absolute monarchies standing in the world. And the second thing is, the economical reforms that he's pushing for the new prince cannot be done without introducing real political reforms. They have to go, they go together. Without real political reforms, we'll still have the corruption, we'll still have the class system, we'll still have all these educated women who cannot join the workforce. And I hope the political reforms is next. I'm hopeful. The only thing keeps me going, believe me, in this life is hope for better things. And as I said, I was not. If I concentrate or I focus on the things I couldn't do, I wouldn't be anywhere. I always focus on what can I do, and if I can't do it, what can I do about it? And I think that's the position we should really run our hopes for a better society. We are 147 countries around the world. In the Global Gap Index, we rank in the last 10, actually in the last 5. I know we have the capability in Saudi Arabia to be ranked in the top 10. It just takes a political decision to include these women. And Saudi women are badass, if you don't know about that. I'm pretty sure once things are changed to be fully involved in the political system and in the workforce, things will really change for the government and the country.
Do we have any other questions? I can see a hand right up the back, and then I'm going to come to this lady here. So we'll go to the very back row.
What do you think the future is for the guardianship system in Saudi Arabia?
So growing up, I had a huge list of the guardianship I need to take permission. We have only down to 4 now. And so June 24, I'm going back home, driving with my son across the country. We're a really huge country, by the way, the size of Western Europe, bigger than Western Europe. I'm going to drive, it's 1,200 kilometers with my son, and I'm going to tweet about it, talk about it. And the drive, I call it the drive for freedom, where I'm asking women like you who have driver license and drive to McDonald's to dedicate these miles to women, which will be milesforfreedom.net. It will be launched in May. And that, instead of collecting signatures, we're collecting miles, sending it in a petition to the king for full citizenship for Saudi women. And that's, the male guardianship is just part of it, the full citizenship for women in Saudi Arabia. But yeah, we are working on it. It's gonna.
We might come to just in the middle here on the on my left.
Hi.
I realise that you've concentrated on the cultural rather than the religious side of your talk about your country.
Yes.
But I would love to know what you feel about the work of people like Ayan Hirsi Ali, yes, who is really campaigning for a reformation of Islam.
Yes. It's very interesting. This is not recorded. I stopped practicing my religion at the age of 30. And I became more spiritual. For me, any ideology of hate, I'm completely against. And it is true that Islam being sabotaged by a group of people who who wants the power, and they use the religion to control the people. And that was very dangerous when you don't question. If anyone tell you this is the truth and don't question it, question it. And that's, I think, what the clerics and the scholars in the Muslim world, they need to revisit the textbooks and the interpretation of the textbooks that have been sabotaged by misogynists, by men who really hated women, had issues with women, and they created all these rules for women and against the other. So the most prominent scholar is Ibn Taymiyyah, and you read about it in my book. You'd be horrified when you read the things we studied growing up, which is the hate against the other. And Ibn Taymiyyah came at the time of the Crusades. He's in that environment with Crusades coming, Christians coming and killing all these Muslims. And if anyone read the Crusade, it was one of the worst parts of history. Crusade happened in the medieval times where scientists being killed in Europe, where women who are into remedy and alternative medicine being hunted and burned for witchcraft. And then they had the Crusade. So these clerics wrote the books with so much hate and so much, I'd say, against the other, who's coming here to kill me and take my land and my children. And these textbooks are still taught today, at the time of the UN, at the time of all these conventions, at the time of... That's the mistake, that's the problem. These books should be burned, should not be even taught in schools. And new books written based on the text, on the current situation of the world is changing every day. I could not, if you read the Bible, I was sitting with my Christian friend, and I was reading, I was like, oh my God, it's so demeaning to women. And it was even the Old Testament and the Talmud, my Jewish friends too. And I'm like, I'm happy that they don't practice it today, because I would just go crazy if I. And that's the problem with the Islamic texts. They still want to practice something 1,400 years ago, today. And that's, I think, what the scholars need to realize. When people left the church, stop really, like, let's say, the gay rights movement, what they do? They kept going to the church? No, they had to just say, we don't want the church to be involved in the politics. And that's the time, because the church was too much. In the history of Roman Empire, the church never sided, it was never on the side of people, if you read that history. The church or the mosque will always be on the side of the power, because they want the power. And that's the time, I think, the Renaissance happened, when there was a separation between the church and the power. The same will happen in the Muslim world, in the Arab and Muslim world. When there is this separation, this spirituality that's personal, your religion is personal, and there is politics and life and civic society, this is separate from the mosque. I think that's what we need to do. I hope so. It's happening.
We've probably got time for one last question. We might go over minutes. Here just in the middle.
Thank you very much for sharing Hi. Your story. Amazing. I was born in Australia in 1972, but although we were born in very different circumstances, I have such parallels with your story. We're segregated by gender pretty early in high school, although it might not be law. Most of us in New South Wales go to single-sex schools. I lost my career in my 30s because gave up for my husband. And I'm just wondering, to what extent do you think that Australian women live under some illusion of freedom when actually we're still fighting gender lines and gender battles
wow.
as well?
Give a round of applause to this lady. You're amazing.
I'm a gender diversity consultant.
Wow.
On your side.
Respect. One of the dangerous things when we think we know it all. Really, I think that's the most. Or we're the lucky ones. Oh, look at this oppressed woman. Here we disconnect. We're all women of the world. Whether Saudi woman, Australian woman, American woman, once we know we're all connected, that's a very important thing to remember. And whatever hurt a woman here hurt me. Whatever gain she gets is my gain too. And I think it's very important to always look, we are here together, no matter which country we are, no matter which culture I come from. I think that's very important. I was in the US, and one of the things that hurt me the most when I'm there talking to women, you poor woman, are you going back to Saudi Arabia? I'm like, yes, I'm going back. But it's a terrible country. Why are you going back? Because it's my country. It's my home. And I'm claiming it back. Or, oh, Saudi woman, so oppressed. Like, when you reach that point, it's problematic because you don't see what are the things around me I have to change or I stand up for. Or I didn't. It's a continuous struggle. And even if you got it all, guess what? If you feel like, ah, oh, I got it all, I'm fine, I'll get busy with my life, it will be taken away from you. You really have to guard it. You really have to keep your eye on it. Because I'm pretty sure amazing women here in Australia, they fought for all the beautiful rights you have today. And those women to be recognized and loved and remembered.
I remember there's a line in the book, and I'm going to quote you for a moment, where you say, the authorities, especially the religious police, always blame the woman. They say she was harassed because of how she looked,
yes,
or because of the way she was walking,
yes,
or because she was wearing perfume. And I remember reading that sentence and thinking, that could
Isn't
be in an
same?
Australian newspaper. Couldn't
it? It could be. But I, when I walk in Sydney, I really want to take photos of all these women doing things. I was in the park ranger, and there was a woman driving. The park ranger. I'm like, this is amazing. A woman, a constructor, a woman, in, a police officer. These things are so beautiful. And it's beautiful that you just, for me, someone, an outsider, like, oh my God, I get struck. But here it's something like, yeah, you can do anything, even the things boys can do in this country. This is amazing.
Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for Manal.